Chapter 109. National and domestic, England has been in a dreadful state for some weeks. Lord Coodle would go out, Sir Thomas Doodle wouldn't come in, and there being nobody in Great Britain to speak of, except Coodle and Doodle, there has been no government. It is a mercy that the hostile meeting between those two great men, which at one time seemed inevitable, did not come off, because if both pistols had taken effect, and Coodle and Doodle had killed each other, it is to be presumed that England must have waited to be governed until young Coodle and young Doodle, now in frocks and long stockings, were grown up. This stupendous national calamity, however, was averted by Lord Coodle's making the timely discovery that if in the heat of debate he had said that he scorned and despised the whole ignoble career of Sir Thomas Doodle, he had merely meant to say that party differences should never induce him to withhold from it the tribute of his warmest admiration. While it as opportunely turned out, on the other hand, that Sir Thomas Doodle had in his own bosom expressly booked Lord Coodle to go down to posterity as the mirror of virtue and honor. Still, England has been some weeks in the dismal strait of having no pilot, as was well observed by Sir Leicester Dedlock, to weather the storm. And the marvelous part of the matter is that England has not appeared to care very much about it, but has gone on eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage as the old world did in the days before the flood. But Coodle knew the danger, and Doodle knew the danger, and all their followers and hangers-on had the clearest possible perception of the danger. At last Sir Thomas Doodle has not only condescended to come in, but has done it handsomely, bringing in with him all his nephews, all his male cousins, and all his brothers-in-law. So there is hope for the old ship yet. Doodle has found that he must throw himself upon the country, chiefly in the form of sovereigns and beer. In this metamorphosed state he is available in a good many places simultaneously, and can throw himself upon a considerable portion of the country at one time. Britannia being much occupied in pocketing Doodle in the form of sovereigns, and swallowing Doodle in the form of beer, and in swearing herself black in the face, that she does neither plainly to the advancement of her glory and morality the London season comes to a sudden end, through all the Doodleites and Coodleites dispersing, to assist Britannia in those religious exercises. Hence Mrs. Rouncewell, housekeeper at Chesney Wold, foresees, though no instructions have yet come down, that the family may shortly be expected, together with a pretty large accession of cousins and others who can in any way assist the great constitutional work. And hence the stately old dame, taking time by the forelock, leads him up and down the staircases, and along the galleries and passages, and through the rooms, to witness before he grows any older, that everything is ready, that floors are rubbed bright, carpets spread, curtains shaken out, beds puffed and padded, still room and kitchen cleared for action, all things prepared as beseems the Dedlock dignity. This present summer evening, as the sun goes down, the preparations are complete. Dreary and solemn the old house looks, with so many appliances of habitation, and with no inhabitants except the pictured forms upon the walls. So did these come and go, a Dedlock in possession might have ruminated passing along, so did they see this gallery hushed and quiet, as I see it now, so think, as I think, of the gap that they would make in this domain when they were gone. So find it, as I find it, difficult to believe that it could be without them. So pass from my world, as I pass from theirs, now closing the reverberating door. So leave no blank to miss them, and so die. Through some of the fiery windows beautiful from without, and set, at this sunset hour, not in dull gray stone, but in a glorious house of gold, the light excluded at other windows pours in rich, lavish, overflowing like the summer plenty in the land. Then do the frozen Dedlocks thaw. Strange movements come upon their features as the shadows of leaves play there. A dense justice in a corner is beguiled into a wink. A staring baronet, with a truncheon, gets a dimple in his chin. Down into the bosom of a stony shepherdess there steals a fleck of light and warmth, that would have done it good 100 years ago. One ancestress of Volumnia, in high-heeled shoes, very like her casting the shadow of that virgin event before her full 2 centuries shoots out into a halo, and becomes a saint. A maid of honor of the court of Charles II, with large round eyes and other charms to correspond, seems to bathe in glowing water, and it ripples as it glows. But the fire of the sun is dying. Even now the floor is dusky, and shadow slowly mounts the walls, bringing the deadlocks down like age and death. And now, upon my lady's picture over the great chimney-piece, a weird shade falls from some old tree, that turns it pale, and flutters it, and looks as if a great arm held a veil or hood, watching an opportunity to draw it over her. Higher and darker rises shadow on the wall, now a red gloom on the ceiling, now the fire is out. All that prospect, which from the terrace looked so near, has moved solemnly away, and changed not the first nor the last of beautiful things, that look so near, and will so change into a distant phantom. Light mists arise, and the dew falls, and all the sweet scents in the garden are heave in the air. Now the woods settle into great masses, as if they were each one profound tree. And now the moon rises to separate them, and to glimmer here and there in horizontal lines behind their stems, and to make the avenue a pavement of light among high cathedral arches fantastically broken. Now the moon is high, and the great house, needing habitation more than ever, is like a body without life. Now it is even awful, stealing through it, to think of the live people who have slept in the solitary bedrooms. To say nothing of the dead. Now is the time for shadow, when every corner is a cavern, and every downward step a pit, when the stained glass is reflected in pale and faded hues upon the floors, when anything and everything can be made of the heavy staircase beams accepting their own proper shapes, when the armor has dull lights upon it not easily, to be distinguished from stealthy movement, and when barred helmets are frightfully suggestive of heads inside. But of all the shadows in Chesney Wold, the shadow in the long drawing room upon my lady's picture is the first to come, the last to be disturbed. At this hour, and by this light it changes into threatening hands raised up, and menacing the handsome face with every breath that stirs. "She is not well, ma'am," says a groom in Mrs. Rouncewell's audience chamber. "My lady not well? What's the matter?" "Why, my lady has been but poorly, ma'am, since she was last here. I don't mean with the family, ma'am, but when she was here as a bird of passage like. My lady has not been out much for her, and has kept her room a good deal." "Chesney Wold, Thomas," rejoins the housekeeper with proud complacency, "will set my lady up. There is no finer air, and no healthier soil in the world." Thomas may have his own personal opinions on this subject, probably hints them in his manner of smoothing his sleek head from the nape of his neck to his temples, but he forbears to express them further, and retires to the servants' hall to regale on cold meat pie and ale. This groom is the pilot fish before the nobler shark. Next evening, down come Sir Leicester and my lady with their largest retinue, and down come the cousins and others from all the points of the compass. Thenceforth for some weeks backward and forward rush mysterious men with no names, who fly about all those particular parts of the country on which Doodle is at present throwing himself in an auriferous and multi-shower, but who are merely persons of a restless disposition, and never do anything anywhere. On these national occasions Sir Leicester finds the cousins useful. A better man than the Honorable Bob Stables, to meet the hunt at dinner, there could not possibly be. Better got up gentlemen than the other cousins, to ride over to polling booths and hustings here and there, and show themselves on the side of England, it would be hard to find. Volumnia is a little dim, but she is of the true descent, and there are many who appreciate her sprightly conversation, her French conundrums so old, as to have become in the cycles of time almost new again, the honor of taking the fair deadlock into dinner, or even the privilege of her hand in the dance. On these national occasions, dancing may be a patriotic service, and Volumnia is constantly seen hopping about for the good of an ungrateful and unpensioning country. My lady takes no great pains to entertain the numerous guests, and being still unwell, rarely appears until late in the day. But at all the dismal dinners, leaden lunches, basilisk balls, and other melancholy pageants, her mere appearance is a relief. As to Sir Leicester, he conceives it utterly impossible that anything can be wanting, in any direction, by anyone who has the good fortune to be received under that roof, and in a state of sublime satisfaction, he moves among the company a magnificent refrigerator. Daily the cousins trot through dust and canter over roadside turf, away to hustings and polling booths with leather gloves, and hunting whips for the counties and kid gloves, and riding canes for the boroughs, and daily bring back reports on which Sir Leicester holds forth after dinner. Daily the restless men who have no occupation in life present the appearance of being rather busy. Daily Volumnia has a little cousinly talk with Sir Leicester on the state of the nation, from which Sir Leicester is disposed to conclude that Volumnia is a more reflecting woman than he had thought her. "How are we getting on?" says Miss Volumnia, clasping her hands. "Are we safe? The mighty business is nearly over by this time, and Doodle will throw himself off the country in a few days more. Sir Leicester has just appeared in the long drawing room after dinner, a bright particular star surrounded by clouds of cousins." "Volumnia," replies Sir Leicester, who has a list in his hand, "we are doing tolerably. Only tolerably. Although it is summer weather, Sir Leicester always has his own particular fire in the evening. He takes his usual screen seat near it, and repeats with much firmness and a little displeasure, as who should say, 'I am not a common man,' and when I say tolerably, it must not be understood as a common expression. 'Volumnia, we are doing tolerably. At least there is no opposition to you,' Volumnia asserts with confidence. 'No, Volumnia. This distracted country has lost its senses in many respects, I grieve to say, but it is not so mad as that. I am glad to hear it.' Volumnia's finishing the sentence restores her to favor. Sir Leicester, with a gracious inclination of his head, seems to say to himself, 'A sensible woman this, on the whole, though occasionally precipitate.' In fact, as to this question of opposition, the fair Dedlock's observation was superfluous, Sir Leicester on these occasions always delivering in his own candidateship, as a kind of handsome wholesale order to be promptly executed. Two other little seats that belong to him, he treats as retail orders of less importance, merely sending down the men, and signifying to the tradespeople, 'You will have the goodness to make these materials into two members of Parliament, and to send them home when done.' I regret to say, Volumnia, that in many places the people have shown a bad spirit, and that this opposition to the government has been of a most determined and most implacable description." "W.R. wretches," says Volumnia. "Even," proceeds Sir Leicester, glancing at the circumjacent cousins on sofas and ottomans, "even in many, in fact, in most of those places in which the government has carried it against a faction, note, by the way, that the Coodleyites are always a faction with the Doodleyites, and that the Doodleyites occupy exactly the same position towards the Coodleyites. Even in them I am shocked, for the credit of Englishmen, to be constrained to inform you that the party has not triumphed without being put to an enormous expense." "Hundreds," says Sir Leicester, eyeing the cousins with increasing dignity and swelling indignation, "hundreds of thousands of pounds. If Volumnia have a fault, it is the fault of being a trifle too innocent, seeing that the innocence which would go extremely well with a sash and tucker is a little out of keeping with the rouge and pearl necklace. Hobit, impelled by innocence, she asks, 'What for?'" "Volumnia," remonstrates Sir Leicester with his utmost severity. "Volumnia. No, no, I don't mean what for," cries Volumnia with her favorite little scream. "How stupid I am. I mean what a pity. I am glad, returned Sir Leicester, that you do mean what a pity. Volumnia hastens to express her opinion that the shocking people ought to be tried as traitors and made to support the party. I am glad, Volumnia, repeats Sir Leicester, unmindful of these mollifying sentiments, that you do mean what a pity. It is disgraceful to the electors. But as you, though inadvertently and without intending so unreasonable a question, ask me what for? Let me reply to you. For necessary expenses. And I trust to your good sense, Volumnia, not to pursue the subject here or elsewhere. Sir Leicester feels it incumbent on him to observe a crushing aspect towards Volumnia, because it is whispered abroad that these necessary expenses will, in some 200 election petitions, be unpleasantly connected with the word bribery, and because some graceless jokers have consequently suggested the omission from the church service of the ordinary supplication in behalf of the High Court of Parliament, and have recommended instead that the prayers of the congregation be requested for 658 gentlemen in a very unhealthy state. I suppose, observes Volumnia, having taken a little time to recover her spirits after her late castigation, I suppose Mr. Tulkinghorn has been worked to death. I don't know, says Sir Leicester, opening his eyes, why Mr. Tulkinghorn should be worked to death. I don't know what Mr. Tulkinghorn's engagements may be. He is not a candidate. Volumnia had thought he might have been employed. Sir Leicester could desire to know by whom, and what for. Volumnia, abashed again, suggests, by somebody to advise and make arrangements. Sir Leicester is not aware that any client of Mr. Tulkinghorn has been in need of his assistance. Lady Dedlock, seated at an open window with her arm upon its cushioned ledge and looking out at the evening shadows falling on the park, has seemed to attend since the lawyer's name was Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.